And some of these people were being put in a rap stress position, which is a position that is bound you to succumb. And we recently put out a report and a lawsuit that exposes this this treatment, which is called a rap complaint. And people were being literally forced to sign their deportation. People prefer to remain in detention other than be deported back to Cameroon. You can imagine how severe it is. Nobody wants to be in detention, but you know, ICE really forced people and sent them back to danger. And the report documented how they were being treated.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on your victory for Cameroonians getting temporary protected status. Daniel Tse, co-founder of Cameroon Advocacy Network. I'm Amy Goodman.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, applications are now open for Multnomah County's Preschool for All program, a federal judge strikes down the mask mandate for planes and public transportation, and in international news, Ukrainian officials say Russia has begun a new offensive in the eastern Donbas region. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 18th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Families in Multnomah County can now apply for the new free Preschool for All program. The pilot program begins in September, and the county said there are 677 slots open for eligible families. All children who will be 3 or 4 years old by September 1st are eligible, and the programs are free for all children who are accepted. The county encourages families to apply early, since applications will not be accepted once the county receives enough applicants for the limited seats available. Families who have the least access to high-quality preschool will be prioritized in the application process. This includes migrant and refugee children, children who speak languages other than English, children with disabilities, children of teen parents or military families, children living in foster care, children from families affected by low incomes, children who are unhoused, and children from families of color. Those applying are asked to look at the list of preschool options and choose the ones that would work best for them. Families can rank up to 3 different preschool programs on that application. 2 main schedules will be offered for the first year of the Preschool for All program. One will be a full-day schedule with up to 10 hours of care, while the other is a school-day schedule which operates on a traditional school year calendar for about 6 hours per day. Some pilot sites also offer care at special hours for families with alternate schedules. Multnomah County officials noted that submitting an application does not guarantee a child will be accepted to a preschool program. Families will be notified about application decisions in early July. Multnomah County voters approved funding for the Preschool for All program in November of 2020. The service is funded by a 1.5% tax on households with an income of over $125,000 for individuals and $200,000 for joint filers, as well as an additional 1.5% tax on incomes over $250,000 for individuals or $400,000 for joint filers. While the program is only open to 677 students for its first year, the county plans to develop and expand the system over the next 10 years and anticipates it will eventually serve 15,000 to 19,000 preschoolers in Multnomah County. A federal judge on Monday struck down the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's mask mandate for public transportation, calling it unlawful. The ruling comes from U.S. District Court Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell. Mizell said the CDC had overstepped its legal authority by imposing the mandate in February of 2021. Judge Mizell was appointed to the Middle District of Florida bench in 2020 by former President Donald Trump. The CDC has renewed the travel mask mandate several times, most recently extending it through May 3rd. The lawsuit alleged that the CDC mandate was arbitrary and capricious since it gave exemptions to certain groups, like children under 2 years old, but not others. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit are 2 women, Anna Carolina Daza and Sarah Pope, along with the Health Freedom Defense Fund, a Wyoming nonprofit that has challenged COVID vaccine and mask mandates in other parts of the country. Biden administration lawyers have argued that Congress provided broad authority for the CDC to take reasonable public health measures to prevent the spread of disease. Officials have said the mask mandate was a conventional sanitation measure that is within the CDC's authority. The Justice Department did not issue an immediate statement on whether the government would seek to block the judge's order and allow the mandate to remain in effect. The CDC, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Transportation Security Administration said they were evaluating their options in light of that new decision. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Monday that Russia has begun a new offensive in the eastern Donbas region of Ukraine. The Russian military has been building up their forces for an attack on what is considered Ukraine's industrial heartland, an area where Moscow-backed separatists have been fighting for the past 8 years. Also on Monday, Russian missiles struck the western Ukrainian city of Lviv, killing at least 7 people. The attack was a deadly extension of Russia's war into a city that has become a refuge for thousands fleeing eastern Ukraine, as well as a major supply and logistics hub. Officials said the attack serves as a grave reminder that Russian forces would continue to threaten all of Ukraine, even as the Kremlin refocuses its military campaign on the country's east. Moscow has said it intends to step up its attacks on Kiev and supply lines across Ukraine as the war on the ground shifts east. Russian airstrikes disrupted the Easter holiday in Ukrainian cities like Kiev and Kharkiv, where officials said at least 13 people have died in shelling since Sunday night. In the port city of Mariupol, Ukrainian defenders were making a last stand as Russia offered to spare the lives of Ukrainian soldiers fighting in the city if they lay down their arms. Ukrainian forces have rejected the ultimatum. There were no immediate reports of activity from Ukrainian forces in Mariupol. If it falls, it would be the first major city to be taken by Russian forces since the February 24th invasion. The World Bank said Monday that more countries are expected to announce contributions to help Ukraine maintain its government through the organization's multi-donor trust fund and parallel fund this week. Officials said the World Bank was working with the International Monetary Fund to put together a $3 billion package of aid to help Ukraine maintain essential government services. The United Nations has said at least 1,800 civilians have been killed in Ukraine, along with more than 2,500 injured. The UN stressed that the actual figures are likely to be considerably higher. Ukrainians are coming to Washington State to flee the war in their country, but it can be hard for them to find work because of their immigration status. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
The number of Ukrainians arriving in Washington State has increased since the Russian invasion in February. Already, the Evergreen State is home to the third largest population of Ukrainians, after California and New York. Oleg Pinda heads the Ukrainian Community Center of Washington, which provides mental and behavioral health services. He says many people are arriving in the U.S. under the immigration status of humanitarian parole. But Pinda says one big challenge is that they have to file a petition to be able to work.
In average, it takes from 6 to 9 months to get employment authorization. And if you are paroling to U.S. only for 12 months, for 1 year, and waiting for 6 to 9 months for your employment authorization, it kind of doesn't make any sense.
In March, President Joe Biden said the U.S. would welcome 100,000 Ukrainians fleeing the war. They're being welcomed through a variety of immigration channels, some of which include refugee status. Humanitarian parole allows people into the country who would not normally be allowed to obtain a visa. Pinda says leaders in Congress can help people who want to work.
Please expedite their employment authorization application. Not them sit and wait for 6-9 months to get their employment card. Let it do it within a month and eliminate the fee for that application, because the fee for one application goes up to $495.
Because of the war, Pinda says the Ukrainian Community Center of Washington has had to expand its services. He says it can be difficult to serve people without health insurance.
Unfortunately, some people who arrive, they're not eligible for Medicaid, but still they have behavioral health issues that needs to be addressed. So we are collecting financial donations. We are doing some fundraising.
In the past decade, more Ukrainian refugees have arrived in Washington than any other state, according to a Seattle Times analysis. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The U.S. saw three mass shootings over the Easter weekend. In total, the shootings left two minors dead and at least 31 people wounded. Authorities in South Carolina are investigating a shooting at a nightclub early Sunday that wounded at least 9 people. This followed another nightclub shooting in South Carolina where 9 people were shot and 5 others sustained injuries while trying to flee the scene. In South Carolina, residents age 21 or older can get a weapons permit, which as of last year allows them to carry weapons both openly or concealed. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 2 young men were killed and at least 8 people were wounded when shots were fired during a party at a short-term rental property. The weekend mass shootings followed a series of other recent gun violence incidents, including a gunman opening fire on a New York City subway, shooting 10 people and injuring 13 others. Other recent events include a shooting in Sacramento, California, in which 6 people were killed and 12 were wounded, a shooting at a nightclub in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that killed 2 people and wounded 10 others, as well as a shooting in Dallas, Texas, at a spring break party at which at least 10 people were hit by gunfire. Florida lawmakers are preparing to return to Tallahassee on Tuesday to start a 4-day special session to pass new congressional maps as part of the redistricting process. Critics are slamming Republican legislative leaders for helping to further Governor Ron DeSantis' political ambitions as he strips representation for black voters in the state. Tramell Gomes has more.
Florida's redistricting saga continues Tuesday when lawmakers return to Tallahassee for a special session to essentially give the governor what he wants. Legislators passed their own version of Florida's proposed new congressional maps, but Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed them in favor of his own, which favor more Republicans and dismantle districts that ensures representation for black voters. Ellen Frieden with Fair Districts Now led the campaign in 2010 to pass a constitutional amendment to prevent politicians from doing exactly what the governor is doing.
He's really totally disregarding all the voters of Florida, and in particular, black voters in the two districts. He's cutting black representation in Florida by half.
Claiming racial gerrymandering was part of the process, DeSantis wants to split the 5th Congressional District, represented by Democrat Al Lawson, who is black, and the 10th Congressional District, represented by Val Demings, a black Democrat, now running for U.S. Senate. Even though the state constitution puts lawmakers in charge of redistricting, the GOP-controlled legislature agreed to back away from challenging DeSantis despite calls from Democrats to do so. Frieden says she thinks the governor's goal is to get rid of the Fair Districts Amendment, which prevents politicians from drawing districts for their own advantage and ensure fair minority representation.
It's totally unprecedented for a governor to bulldoze his way into redistricting. And again, he's doing it for his own political ambition.
Legal challenges are expected. The once-a-decade process of redrawing maps will affect Floridians' ability to have their voices represented in Congress, at least until the next redistricting process. This is Tramell Gomes.
A coalition of environmental organizations have sued the Environmental Protection Agency, claiming it has failed to enforce the regional haze rule as required by the Clean Air Act. 34 states have missed deadlines to submit plans to reduce air pollution in order to return natural visibility to national parks and wilderness areas. Eric Galatis has the story.
A coalition of environmental organizations are taking the Environmental Protection Agency to court over its failure to enforce the Clean Air Act's regional haze rules designed to reduce pollution in national parks, including Grand Teton and Yellowstone. Rob Joyce with the Sierra Club's Wyoming chapter, one group behind the lawsuit, says states and owners of major polluting facilities have had plenty of time to create a plan to comply with federal law.
When states like Wyoming choose to ignore deadlines for things like the regional haze rule, which protects our wild places from air pollution, then we need the EPA to step in and hold them accountable. And that's exactly what this lawsuit is encouraging them to do.
The EPA amended the regional haze rule in 2017, giving states until July 31st, 2021 to complete their plans to return natural visibility to national parks. 34 states, including Wyoming, missed that deadline and still have not submitted plans. The suit urges the EPA to lock in retirement dates for coal-fired power plants and require other big polluters to limit emissions. Joyce says reducing air pollution will not only make it easier to see the nation's vast natural landscapes, it's also critical for improving health conditions for vulnerable residents, including children, people with asthma, and older adults.
We know that many of these sources of air pollution are located disproportionately next to communities of color. Having the EPA enforce these air rules will not only protect our national parks, but will protect our communities and their health.
Joyce says getting the EPA to enforce the Clean Air Act will also help Wyoming avoid year-round wildfire seasons and other impacts of a warming planet, and help fossil fuel-dependent communities begin to transition into good-paying clean energy jobs.
These states have known about this deadline for years, well back into the Trump administration. Enforceable plans to curb pollution emissions and locking in retirement dates for coal-fired power plants will help protect our national parks, but they can also provide timelines that can help our communities plan for the future.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
You are listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, discussing what happens when a state like Oregon treats drug addiction like a health issue rather than a crime. Reporter Cecilia Brown visits an addiction and recovery center in Portland that's gearing up for what they hope will be an influx of people seeking treatment. Then stick around at 6 for Labor Radio, and at 6:30 we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow that rain continues with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1906, an earthquake estimated at close to 8 on the Richter scale strikes San Francisco, California. Fires immediately broke out, and because broken water mains prevented firefighters from stopping them, firestorms soon developed citywide. It was estimated that some 3,000 people died as a result of the Great San Francisco earthquake and the devastating fires it inflicted upon the city. Almost 30,000 buildings were destroyed, including most of the city's homes and nearly all of the central business district. The quote of the day is from South African anti-apartheid revolutionary and political leader Nelson Mandela, who also served as the first president of South Africa. Mandela said, quote, "To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." Gas lease sales on public lands are set to resume. Russia may be taking custody of any Ukrainian men left in the port city of Mariupol, and Elon Musk regroups in his bid for Twitter. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I cannot help but feel misled, disheartened, and disappointed when I witness the Department of Interior taking steps to lease more public lands to oil and gas, all in the name of profit.
Environmentalists, including White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council member Jade Begay, are blasting a move to resume leasing federal lands. President Joe Biden called for an end to drilling on public lands on the campaign trail, but now faces mounting pressure to increase U.S. energy production to lower gas prices. But New Mexico State Senator Carrie Hamblin says diversifying away from fossil fuels can better protect communities.
Oil and gas pollution is a social and environmental justice issue, and communities across the country are being treated as disposable so that money can be made by the few off of the backs of the many.
The Bureau of Land Management will post sale notices today for 144,000 acres. Russian troops look to finally take Mariupol and may take custody of any man who remain there. The now-leveled southern Ukrainian city has held out since the start of the invasion, blocking Russian plans to connect two areas they control. The mayor's office says the invaders are filtering out all the Ukrainian men for forced service, labor, or isolation. Russia is warning that U.S. weapons shipments could lead to, quote, unpredictable consequences, unquote, while Ukraine's president is warning that Russia could use nuclear or chemical weapons. Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the odds of that are low.
It's hard to see what the military target of a chemical weapon would be that would have strategic significance that would outweigh the potential international consequences.
Moscow announced sanctions against British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The UK has shipped significant weapons to Ukraine. China slammed a visit to Taiwan by a congressional delegation, including South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
To abandon Taiwan would be to abandon democracy and freedom. It would be to abandon free trade. It would reward the worst in humanity.
Beijing staged military drills in response to the visit and reaffirmed its claim on the self-governed island. President Biden will nominate former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Michael Barr as the Federal Reserve's head of financial supervision. Barr helped lead a regulatory overhaul of the sector during the Obama administration after the bank-led financial crisis of 2008. Elon Musk is reportedly talking with investors about a new bid to buy Twitter. Twitter responded to Musk's first $43 billion takeover offer by diluting his shares. Today is the tax filing deadline. According to the Tax Foundation, the top half of federal income taxpayers will pay about 15%, while the bottom half about 3.5%. President Biden and the First Lady paid more than $150,000 for 2021, about 25% of their income. And after a two-year hiatus due to COVID, the White House Easter egg roll is back. 30,000 kids and their guardians will participate in today's event, which dates back to 1876. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Students in Alaska gather to compete in Native Youth Olympics events, and Arizona State University is making progress in recruiting Native American faculty and students. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Students from Bethel and Dillingham schools in Alaska recently gathered to compete in the 1 foot high kick and 9 other Native Youth Olympics events. The games determine who from those schools will make it to state competition. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports the games have a particular significance for students with Yupik heritage.
The gym at Bethel Regional High School is as quiet as it can get. All eyes in the bleachers are on the court. Eighth grader Danielle Patterson is starting her pre-one-foot high kick ritual. If she gets this kick, she stands to beat her own personal record by 4 inches. Patterson stands in front of the seal and caribou skin ball hanging by a string from a wooden post. She looks intently at the ball, then kicks her leg high and straight at it while pointing her toe like a ballerina. This is practice. She takes 3 large steps backwards to the starting line.
And then I rock back and forth, and I always shake my hands because that, like, calms me down.
Then she starts her approach.
I try to run really fast and then try to do a light jump stop so I can have my momentum.
And her process must have worked. Patterson has just won the one-foot high kick event with a personal record.
I can't stop shaking after kicking 70.
The one-foot high kick is said to be a test of a hunter's strength and agility. Bethel Regional High School Athletic Director Darren Lieb said all these games have a special significance.
These games kind of translated from inside a sod hut or whatever back in the early days, not only just to keep them busy and sane, but to keep them in shape.
Another coach, Wilton Charles, says they've been played all over the Arctic, though each place has its own variation. Charles is from Tuksuk Bay, on the coast. He says the Neil Jump has a particular meaning for coastal Yupiat.
Our ancestors used to kayak with their knees on the base of the kayak and then nail jump out of the kayak.
Charles and Lieb stress that these are just games. And lots of the kids I talk to say that's what they love about the Native Youth Olympics. It takes some of the pressure off. But it is still a competition too, and a challenging one at that. The most skilled Native Youth Olympians will compete at the state tournament on April 20th in Anchorage. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
An article in the Chronicle of Higher Education points to progress made at Arizona State University in recruiting Native American faculty and students to the Tempe campus. Mark Richardson has more.
Arizona is home to more than 20 tribes and about 400,000 indigenous citizens, but until the late 1990s, they were underrepresented at state universities. ASU founded the Center for Indian Education about 20 years ago in response to a growing number of indigenous students on campus. Center Director Brian Brayboy said there was a clear need to hire more Native faculty members.
We wanted to get really intentional about listening to our students who were saying to us that they wanted more faculty that looked like them and they wanted to be seen. They felt invisible. And so we sat down and we made a plan to try to address that.
Even though the Native students make up only about 1% of ASU's enrollment, many are the first in their family and in their community to attend college. Brayboy says that led them to recruit 60 indigenous scholars in teaching positions. Mark Richardson reporting.
Bemidji State University is hosting a series of events this week leading up to Earth Day on Friday. The university has partnered with several Minnesota colleges and universities to offer both events in person and virtually. Monday's agenda includes a discussion on indigenous and Western science. A list of events can be found online at bemidjistate.edu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Illinois is encouraging a transition to electric vehicles. The state is offering incentives to buyers and providing rebates and grants for new charging stations. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Biden administration has set a goal that half of all new cars sold in the U.S. will be electric by 2030. And many states are creating plans to encourage drivers to make the switch. Christian Mitchell is Deputy Governor for Public Safety, Infrastructure, Energy, and the Environment in Illinois.
The governor has a very exciting goal around electric vehicles. We want to have 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2030, and we are attacking that from all ends. On the cost side, we're providing a $4,000 incentive for consumers to go out and buy an electric vehicle.
Combined with federal tax credits, that can lower the price of an EV by more than $10,000. But cost is not the only barrier to EV adoption. Some drivers are hesitant to go electric because they're worried they'll run out of battery power on longer drives.
The question is, can I take an electric vehicle from start to finish? How do I make sure there are enough chargers between here and there to know that I can get to my destination with reasonable reliability?
So to help expand charging infrastructure, the state will offer rebates and grants to cover up to 80% of the cost of installing new charging stations. Mitchell says the investments will help position Illinois as a leader in the transition to electric vehicles. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 18th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tramel Gomes, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Galatis, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Susan Herring about her show, Our House on Fire, on Now at the Waterstone Gallery. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. Thank you. Now is a great time to become a member. So if you'd like to do that and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.